Let's just take a moment to consider what's happened over here. Basically, what we've got over here is we have finished in Seder Moed. We have finished the Inyanim of Shabbos and the Regolim, and those days that are similar to Shabbos, which includes, of course, Pesach, which is called Shabbos, and Yom Kippur, which is Shabbat Shabbaton. Don't get confused about the fact that Rosh Hashanah comes later, because Rosh Hashanah is not about the holiday of Rosh Hashanah. You'll remember that. And it's basically a general analysis of astronomical issues, the Arba Rosh Hashanah, and there can be all kinds of different dinim. It's not really fundamentally Mesechet on the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, of course. So what we're about to do is to do an extensive examination of the differences between the level of the Kedusha of Shabbos and the Kedusha of Yontav in terms of how it's expressed in the difference in Melachos. And the differences in those Melachos lead to some tremendous deeper understandings and more fundamental considerations, which of course is going to be Nogea, the main difference. And the main difference is that the Torah said that when it comes to Yontav, that anything that is a need for Ochal Nefesh, you are allowed to do on Yontav. So it says, Kol Achashe Yachel Ochal Nefesh, Hulavado Yasalachem, which is clearly a Yisod that something about eating on Yontav makes a difference to the whole question of Yontav. We're going to see how far this extends and how it completely changes our relationship to the preparation of food. And from there, the fact that the Torah changes the concept of melacha to melechet avodah instead of just plain melacha is also, according to some Rishonim, going to be the basis of an overall distinction which will extend the concept of ochal nefesh into a general idea of the difference between melechet avodah, the type of melacha which is an avodah, as opposed to the type of melacha which is part of your enjoyment and part of the things that you're doing. Because that leads to a very different ambience about Yontav. And of course, there's a general question bechalal about the relationship of hotzah, which is the main topic of Shabbos, and how Hotzah affects Shabbos versus how Hotzah affects Yontav, and the issue of Tchumim on Shabbos and Yontav. So because of that, obviously it's going to affect the idea of Muktzah, which is an extension, as the Rivet defines totally, it's an extension of the concept of Hotzah, but it's more profoundly, according to the Rambam, it's the thing that creates the ambience of the day. Muktzah is the ambience. So the question is, we're going to begin with what appears to be a lot of unrelated issues. But you'll note that all of the issues, there's a similarity in the Mishnah here, in the issues that are going to be brought up, the similarity is that they are basically all discussing something that has to do, it's true that they all have to do with what appeared to be Kulos of Beit Shammai and Chumas of Beit Hillel that reflect upon the dinim specifically of how we relate to the Shabbos and Yontav issues. But there is not really very much of a connection to the three issues that we're about to bring up in the Mishnah. This Mishnah, by the way, is one of the most wonderful examples of how Rabbeinu HaKadosh, was able to put in things in the Mishnah that would have so many totally different approaches as to how to read and how to apply, that we're going to have an amazing list of different, but when I say different, I mean, might as well be on different planets as far as what's going on. If there doesn't be any connection between them whatsoever, then they contradict each other and all fit directly into an understanding of what these machlokasim will be. Okay, so let's start now at the beginning. And even though these things, again, are not directly, but they are all issues of Yontav, and they are issues of Yontav that have to do with food and the differences between Yontav and Shabbos as well, as we're going to see. So we start off with a strange situation. As Ira was kind enough to give us some video introductions yesterday to anybody who doesn't know what an egg is, or anyone doesn't know that eggs actually come from birds, which, you know, you never know nowadays.
The Rebbe is saying the Mishnah is a nested reality.
That's right. And also, of course, the amount of investment, as Ira has showed us, that goes into a trip to IKEA for a bookshelf in order to get your eggs ready for Shabbos. So in any event, if you have a situation in which an egg was actually laid, Shinolda does not mean that it actually hatched. Shinolda, as applied to an egg, means it was laid on Yom Tov. Notice that the Torah actually treats the Beitzim as if they're Efrochim when it comes to the dinner of Shiluach HaKein. So we use these words as if they apply equally to the egg, and we actually darshan the idea of the batayana and so on. But in any event, the Beitz of Shinolda b'Yom Tov. So what exactly is the problem about an egg that was laid on Yom Tov? It's not clear. I mean, you're allowed to eat, you're allowed to even shecht something on Yom Tov to eat it. I mean, so if you could shecht the mother hen, why in the world couldn't you eat the egg? This is all something, of course, that we're going to immediately take up in the Gemara, but there seems to be some kind of strange problem about an egg that was laid on Yom Tov. And with Machlokes, Beit Shammai says, well, you can eat that egg on Yom Tov. And Beit Hillel says, no, you can't eat that egg on Yom Tov. And we'll see that there's a question whether that includes, does that mean you're not even allowed to move the egg on Yom Tov? And the truth is that there are certain issues in which muktzah in terms of achila is more chomor than muktzah in terms of moving. So basically, I think we're going to see in the Gemara, and it doesn't speak so over here, but it is a bit of a machlokas rishonim, but that actually Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are using the word teachel because that's what you usually do with eggs, but it does not mean to imply it can be eaten, but it cannot be handled according to Beit Shammai. And that's for sure not because ein achila without handling it, and it does not mean lo teachel necessarily according to Beit Hillel. It means you're not even allowed to move it. Okay, another machlokas, completely unrelated. Beit Shammai omrim that the question of on Pesach, how large a piece of chometz or sa'or you would need in order to be over on Bal Yera'eh and Bal Yematzeh. So Beit Shammai says it depends whether it's sa'or or whether it's chometz. You'll recall the Salocha, which we just had recently when we were learning Masechet Pesachim, that sa'or has an advantage in terms of its chimutz over just plain chametz, because it is a very powerful leavener. So we'll leaven other things. Therefore, Taina is Beit Shammai, that when we're talking about the iser of se'or beveitecha, so then se'or beveitecha is even a kezias of se'or. But when it asserts the bayimatzeh in terms of chametz, that would require a larger shear, and that's the shear of a kotevet. So whatever the shear of a kezias is, the machlokas or the shlish beitza, remember that we came out when we were talking about Yom Kippur that a kotevet is actually carved to the shear of the beitza. So could be, even according to Roshitas, a kezias is half a beitza. There's a big difference between a kezias and a kotevet. Whereas Beit Hillel Amrin, there's no difference between chametz and sa'or. This was a machlokas. We'll go through it again in the Gemara, but we had machlokas in this back. Now there's a third machlokas which has nothing to do with the other two. And that is that if somebody is going to be shochet, a chaya or an oaf on Yom Tov, now he runs into a problem because you're not allowed to be shochet if you're not going to be able to be mekayim the mitzvah of Kisui Hadam. How exactly would you be mekayim the mitzvah of Kisui Hadam on Yom Tov since there might be a problem of whether you're allowed to dig a hole? Are you allowed to dig a hole? All the machlokas in, all the malachas on Shabbos apply to Yom Tov, unless it's in terms of tzarech ochel nefesh. Is digging a hole to cover the blood? I mean, to get the dirt to cover the blood, is that considered to be tzarech ochel nefesh? And by the way, is it really true that only if something is directly part of your need to be able to eat on Yom Tov, that then it would be mutter? Or, as we're going to see, there is a concept of mitok shehutra litzarach, which anami shelo litzarach, which seems like, wow, smash open the entire question of what you'd be allowed to do on Yontif. And of course, as we know, we do lots of things on Yontif that are malachas that are not directly related to eating. I mean, we carry a handkerchief around in your pocket from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah on Yontif, and so on and so forth. So this mission is giving us some sort of basic kind of things hidden within what appear to be very specific kind of questions. So Beit Shammai says, okay, so use a spade or something and dig a little bit of earth up and be mechasa v'dam. Whereas Beit Hillel says, don't you dare. Do not do a shechita on Yontif of that which requires kisui adam, which of course is not a behema. It would only be a chai of oaf that requires kisui adam. Don't do it unless you have already set aside some dirt which is roi to be used. But their moda, the Chinese moda, if you went ahead and you did it, and you did not prepare the offer from before, then even Beit Hillel is made to Beit Shammai, Shiach Por B'Deker V'Yechaseh, that you would be allowed to dig up the earth for some reason. This is very strange. And the next words are even stranger. She'ev, why am I saying this? She'ev for Kira Muchanu. What? Because the ashes in a stove that you've left over from cooking are considered to be Muchan to use. What in the world? Didn't you just say you can dig up the dirt? So, of course, the Gemara is going to point out that this is a total non sequitur. What the heck is this all about? That we're going to all take a look at in the Gemara. Now, our first question, the obvious question is, if we're talking about a bird, which you could simply shecht and eat the bird, how in the world would the egg be more usser than the bird itself? Isn't that strange? So let's first discuss what type of bird we're talking about. Because as we saw in Ira's video, there are birds that are put into IKEA cabinets for the expressed purpose of laying eggs for Ira's breakfast. Now, those kind of birds are certainly not the kind of bird that you want to pick up out of their IKEA cabinet and check them, because then you're not going to have eggs for breakfast that week. So that would mean that that kind of bird is set aside for its mothering eggs purposes, and therefore it's not considered to be ro'oi for eating because I've set it aside for hatching or for laying. So what kind of bird are we talking about? Is this a bird that I could actually shecht on Yontif and it just happened to have laid an egg, but it's in a totally different kind of cabinet? So then why in the world Beit Hillel says you're not allowed to eat the egg? If you're allowed to eat the mother, how could you not be allowed to eat the egg? I mean, understand, if you've got something which is food, and now let's say you have a piece of meat. So now you've got the side of an animal. You cut out a steak. So now you're going to say, well, no, steak wasn't here. I mean, it's muksa. What is that supposed to mean? It was here. It was in a different form. And now I've cut it up. And now it's ready to be put on my barbecue. I don't get it. So the same thing is true over here. I could have shechted the mother. And if I shechted the mother, then I could have eaten the egg inside of it. And if a piece of the mother comes out, so to speak, because now it's laid an egg, that's uchla di ifrat. Uchla di ifrat means a piece of food that's become separated from the other food that it was attached to. I mean, so why would that be mukta in any way? So we can't be talking about that. I mean, we must be talking about, as a given, that the Tarnagolet that we're talking about over here is, in fact, the Tarnagolet, which itself I wouldn't be able to shecht on Yontif. And now the question is, since it was set aside for eggs, so then I'm not allowed to eat the egg because the egg is muktzah. But then why would Beit Shammai say that it's okay? I mean, isn't there clearly a concept of muktzah that we've spoken about so many times back in the Masechet Shabbat? This is a problem. Anybody who learned the second Shabbat remembers that muktzah is a big issue. Not everybody agrees to muktzah. Remember the big machlokas about Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon back in the beginning of the Masechet about whether a nair that you had lit, if it goes out, is afterwards, does it remain muktzah? And that was a big question. We have over there the questions of Mukshamachas Mius and Mukshamachas Isser. And Rabbi Shimon said, what's the problem? There's no problem because Rabbi Shimon doesn't hold the Muks. And I remember, these are very confusing statements because there are so many different levels of Muktza. So the way that we understood the entire issue in Masechet Shabbat is that it actually means exactly what it says. Rabbi Shimon does not hold of Muktza at all. But what that means is he does not hold that things simply are Muktza. Things don't get a din of Muktza because of themselves. They get a din of Muktza because of what Muktza means, set aside. So obviously he agrees there's a concept of setting something aside specifically not to be used. So for instance, is Rabbi Shimon agreeable to the concept of Muktza on Muktza Machmas Chisaron Kis? You have your Shechita knife, which you set aside on Shabbat. Of course Rabbi Shimon says, well, you can't take that Shechita knife and now use it to spread butter. What's the matter with you? That's something that people specifically put away in a safe, in a drawer. If you put it away, that's not what muktza means. That's something that you were muktzeh. But the question of muktza, that's just because, I don't know, you weren't thinking of using it in that way. That's not muktza. So you have a lit candle. I understand that while it is lit, fine. But why in the world, just because it was lit, so now it's muktza, you're not allowed to use it for the rest of the Shabbos? Why would I say that? And therefore, the question that you're asking on Beit Shammai over here doesn't make any sense. What do you mean, doesn't Beit Shammai hold a muktzah? For heaven's sakes, muktzah automatic? Maybe he doesn't. I don't know. I mean, it's machlokas in the Mishnah Gufa in Shabbos between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. It says right there, V'Rabbi Shimon Matir. So what's your problem? Umay Kusha, Dilma Beit Shammai, let lo muktzah. Maybe Beit Shammai simply doesn't hold the whole idea of muktzah. Now, I'll tell you why we were asking the question. Because the fact that we talk about a beitza shenolda brings out that we are dealing with a very special case here. And that is called nolad. Nolad means it wasn't here at all. Okay? Nobody saw this egg before. Now, I understand that there may be a question about whether something is set aside from usage because Rabbi Shimon says, I understand if it's there, why wouldn't I use it? Unless, of course, it's something that I don't want anybody to use and I lock it away and so on and so forth. Yes, that I understand. But the question would be, if something didn't exist at all, now in a sense, the Beitza didn't exist. So what we thought was that even if Rabbi Shimon does not hold of Muktza, he does hold of Nolad, where something wasn't there before. Now listen, gentlemen, there is an open Mishnah about what the din is, even according to Rabbi Shimon, with Nolad. We had that back in Masechet Shabbat, which as Tosis points out, well, we talked about the case. Ein mesikin b'shivrei kelim, on Yontif, this was back in Masechet Shabbos. So something breaks. So now I've got a broken wooden bowl. What do I do with a broken wooden bowl? So I want to use it for fuel. Now, on Yom Tov, I'm allowed to burn things, obviously, and to cook with them, right? So I take my broken bowl. Can I do that? According to Rabbi Yehuda, no, you can't do that because it was not set aside for purposes of burning. It was a bowl before. Now it's turned into fuel. That's nolad. And over there, Rabbi Shimon says that, no, that's perfectly okay. So we know that Rabbi Shimon holds that there's no problem of nolad either. But as Tosis points out, don't get confused by terminology. There is obviously a difference between an egg that is laid and a bowl that is broken. The bowl that is broken is nolad only in the sense of its current functionality. You never looked at it as fuel, and therefore the fuel was nolad. But the bowl wasn't nolad. The bowl's been here the whole time. So telling me that, well, I know, obviously, Rabbi Shimon does not hold that nolad is any worse than muktzah. That's not true. Because nolad, in the sense of appearing out of nowhere, where yesterday night Ira checked that IKEA shelf, and there were no eggs there. He comes back in the morning, and all of a sudden, he's got a fresh egg for breakfast. So where the heck did that come from? It's magic. And therefore, magic, Rebbe Shimon, is mega. This was never here in the world before for me to think about. So is it not clearly a different kind of issue? He doesn't know the Muksa. Something was in the world. Why would people say that, well, I don't know, I wasn't considering using it. Who cares? When you wake up in the morning, anything in the world is your potential, and it's your oyster. So now the question is, oh, I meant an egg. It's your egg. So if that's the case, the idea over here may well be different because this wasn't in the world. So, Enochinami, that's what we thought. And that's why we were asking, how could Beit Shammai be matir? Isn't everyone agreeable to Noilad being Osir? So therefore, Kasalka Data, so we thought that even Rabbi Shimon is matir mukta certainly agrees that Noilad is Osir. That's why we were saying, so what's Beit Shammai thinking about? So because of that, Reb Nachman says, okay, here's my take on the Mishnah. Now we're going to see that this is one take of many that are so totally different. But here's take one on understanding the Mishnah. Okay, we're talking about a Tarnagolet, which is in fact there for purposes of laying eggs. Okay, and if that's the case, you're right, there should be a Muksa problem, and that's good for the point over here. Only those who hold of Muksa hold of Noilad. But anybody who doesn't hold of Muksa, like Rabbi Shimon, doesn't believe that Noilad is any worse than Muksa. And the question of whether the world is your oyster, is your egg, is a question that does not affect UFOs. Not an issue. I had no idea that these aliens were going to come down yesterday. So what? Anything's possible. The aliens are also your eggs. So if that's the case, Noilad makes no difference. And therefore, it's very simple. Beit Shammai holds of Rabbi Shimon. Beit Hillel holds of Rabbi Yehuda. And that's the simple machlokas, the same machlokas we had back in Shabbos. And it's expanding that idea is a machlokas, even the Gabi total Noilad. Hey, wait a second. Reb Nachman couldn't have said that. That's ridiculous. Reb Nachman actually says the opposite. He never would have said that Beis Hillel holds like Rabbi Yehuda because we have the Mishnah in Shabbos that says, Beit Shammai omri marbiyimi ala shulchan atzamotu klipim. That when you've got, at the end of a meal, you've got all of these broken bones, your chicken bones are sitting there, they fell on your table, or you've got the broken shells of the nuts that you've been gnashing on, and so on. But so Beit Shammai says, so what's the problem? So take them off of the table and put them in the garbage pail. Beit Hillel says, no, you can't pick them up directly. What you can do is you can take the board, that they're, let's say they're on the challah board or some type some learned that this means a board on the floor to catch things. The pashtas, as the Mishbura ends up, and we're talking about where you have the top of the table is basically a board that you can move or a tablecloth that you can move. You can take that whole thing and you can shake off the things on it. Now, Tosafos asks the obvious question, what do you mean? But what happened to the problem of basis l'davar ha'asur? I mean, if you're going to tell me that you're not allowed to handle the thing itself, why isn't it a basis? This revolves around a lot of questions, which include the Rabbeinu Tam, who says that a basis l'davar ha'asur would only be usur in the case that you had actually set this aside. Because he says it's not a basis unless you had in mind to leave it there the whole day. You certainly didn't have in mind to leave your filthy tablecloth there the whole day with all of this stuff on it. So according to Rabbeinu Tam, it's bichlal, not a question. But there are other issues as well. And that would be, even if you don't hold the Rabbeinu Tam, but what about if, I mean, you certainly didn't put them down on the table. They fell on the table. Your chicken bones fell on the tablecloth or your nutshells. You don't care where the nutshells are going to fall. If they fall on the floor, it's perfectly okay with you all. So you're going to sweep the floor. So therefore, you can't call it a bus. You have no interest in it being specifically on the tablecloth. So that's another approach that's not called a basis. And bichlal, it may be that everybody's made it, that if the intention is to remove them immediately, for sure, even the only Rabbeinu Tam, that's not the kol hayom kulo, that it's not considered to be a basis. Okay, so let's not worry about the basis of davar ha'asur. All we want to point out over here is that Reb Nachman disagrees with that Mishnah. Okay, Reb Nachman says that's the wrong girsa, because the girsa that you're telling me is is that Beit Hillel holds a Rabbi Yehuda and Beit Shammai holds a Rabbi Shimon. And that's exactly what Reb Nachman said over here. And yet over there, Reb Nachman says, that's wrong. We have a Kabbalah from our Rebbe. Anu ein lanu. We don't hold on this Mishnah. Ela Beit Shammai ki Rabbi Yehuda. We know that Beit Shammai is the one who holds that it's Osir L'chumra. And Beit Hillel holds like Rabbi Shimon L'kula. Oh my gosh. So this is like the exact opposite of what Rabbi Nachman is saying. How could Rabbi Nachman contradict himself to such an extent? By the way, I just want to point out, there's a machlokas rishonim about whether we're talking about bones and shells that are ro'i for achilas behema. And the question is that we're allowed to move them only because they're ro'i achilas behema, or even if that's a machlokas rashi and tosis, many other rishonim, which, by the way, I also should point out, that there's a machlokas among later poskim about whether royal achilas behema is only if there are behemas. That's a big question. There's some who hold that if you don't have any behemas around, so then why would it be considered to be machal behema? Now, Reb Shlomo Zalman poskins that machal behema is machal behema. I mean, it's a category. It doesn't have to do with the fact that you're going to use it for behema. Rav Scheinberg wanted to say that behemoths would include cats and dogs out in the yard, but Rabbi Yashiv didn't agree to that. Okay, but so you can see how recently these questions were actually raised. In any event, so getting back to the main point, how do we explain the fact that Reb Nachman completely contradicts himself as to the positions of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel relative to the machlokas of Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda? That here he's claiming that Beit Shammai, who is being Makel, is going like Rabbi Shimon, and Beit Hillel, who's being Mak, was going like Rabbi Yehuda, whereas he himself says in Masechet Shabbos that no, that's wrong, and it's the wrong girsa, and it's actually Beit Shammai, who's Machmer like Beit Hillel, Rabbi Yehuda, and it's Beit Hillel, who is Makel like Rabbi Shimon. Now, this is one of the really exciting openings, because the idea over here is, as we mentioned before, that the Masechet is focusing on the contrast between the nature of Aveda, Melechus Aveda and Melacha, and because of that, the implications of these differences vis-a-vis Shabbos and Yontif. And the Mishnah, according to Reb Nachman, opens up with precisely that point. And astonishingly, it's that point that causes us to reverse the opinion about what is the fundamental normative halacha l'gabei muktzah between Shabbos and Yontif. Shabbos, which, as we'll see, there is a Stam Mishnah that takes for granted that the halacha is actually like Rabbi Shimon, as we're going to see. Therefore, on Shabbos, we do not pasken the churbas of muktzah. But Yontif, where there's a Stam Mishnah like Rabbi Yehuda, we're more machmir than on Shabbos. And the reason for that is going to turn out to be gufa, the difference between Shabbos and Yontif. Because when it comes to Yontif, when we're doing all kinds of things, and whether that the shorish of those things is Orchol Nefesh, and whether it extends into Mitoch Shutu Letzorach or not, the point is that people's attitude about Yontif is, well, it's, you know, it's sort of okay because I need it, you know, so it's okay. So that attitude of I sort of need it and it's okay leads to a deeper appreciation of the need for muktzah. Remember how muktzah evolved. We had back in the second Shabbat that muktzah evolved at the time of Ezra Nehemiah as a blanket iser to move anything, even a fork, unless you were moving it specifically for that purpose for which it was made. So you're moving the fork in order to eat with it, because there was a general sense of lackadaisical shmira of Shabbos in the Inyanim of Shabbos, as is described. People used to bring in things to sell on Shabbos, and it was like complete efkeres. So because of that, they were very, very machmir. That's like the Ponovitch Rav said when he went to Joburg. Remember that famous statement? So the Ponovitch Rav went to shul, you know, and after shul, they're walking out, and this rich guy drives up with his fancy limousine. Would the Rav like a ride? After Shabbos davening. So the Bnei Avraham Rav said, now I understand. There is no Chilul Shabbos in Joburg at all. There's just the complete bittul of Shabbos. People don't even know it exists. So if that's the point, when that was going on at the time of Ezra Nehemiah, It was muktza that the Gemara describes in Shabbos, that total original muktza that bashed everything back into place by making a total separation between Hanukkah on Shabbos and any other time. And then remember, the Gemara goes through how they gradually loosened the rules about muktza to allow more. And there came the different types of muktza, you know, with the muktza malchus bias and muktza malchus isra and muktza malchus kitzar and kis and klisha malach dola isra and basis dabra azur, so on and so forth. Each one of these categories ended up being a gradated approach to muktza. So now when we come back to Yontav, we're faced with a little bit of the same original problems that Ezra and Nehemiah faced because of the fact that people are makel when it comes to Yontav. And this really is a strong basis for the Rambam's stress on muktza as a continued need to distinguish between one's activities on Shabbos and one's activities b'chol. Therefore, as I said before, it's an ambience issue. So since on Yom Tov there is a general ambience of kula, it turns out that the opening mission, according to Rav Nachman, is coming to describe how we needed to create changes in that ambience to paskin one way l'chumra on Yom Tov for muktza like Rav Yehuda, and one way l'kula on Shabbos that it should come out like Rabbi Shimon. So now let's do that inside. Rav Nachman, listen here, guys. I'm not contradicting myself. There are two different worlds here. One is when I was talking to you about, I don't accept this Mishnah. I believe that Basil, the way I was Makabal it, Basil is Lakula, and he holds up Rabbi Shimon. Well, that's absolutely true. But that was Nogea Shabbos and picking up the tablecloth on Shabbos. Now here we're talking about Yontav, and that is totally different. Gabi Shabbat. This Satam Lantanik Rabbi Shimon. So when we're talking about Shabbos, where the Tana himself in the Mishnah created the Stam Mishnah, as we're going to see in a moment, and the Halach is Stam Mishnah. Okay, so over there we have a Stam Mishnah like Rabbi Shimon, where it's not Beferish Mishnah and Shabbos almost at the end of the Sechet. Mechatchinat Adiluin Lifnei Abeima. You can cut up your pumpkins on Shabbos. Now that's not that pumpkins are mukta. It's that. Well, what is it? Well, according to Rashi, the Kiddush about the pumpkin is irrelevant to us here, and it's only a question that's not considered to be too much tircha to do on Shabbos day, because it's sometimes really hard to cut through a pumpkin, as you can ask Moshe Forman, who really does a lot of pumpkin work every year of Shabbos, and I'm sure he would be willing to share with us, as Ira shared. Yeah, there we go. Okay, there we've got that. There we go. So, you know, Ira, I don't know, you may have been outdone over here. I mean, do you have pumpkins handy? Just unbelievable. Okay, so this is for the art scroll world that needs to put a picture in when it describes a pumpkin. We got it. Anyway, so you're allowed to cut those up. According to Tosfos, the problem isn't that it's tircha. According to Tosfos, the problem is that in doing so, you soften it and you make it roy for achila, so it's tikkun or whatever, but it's not. This is not our sugya. It's the next words that have to do with muktza. And you can cut up a nevela, even if that animal died on Shabbos, you can cut up that nevela to feed to the dogs. Now, how in the world could you do that if it was living before Shabbat? It certainly was not set aside in your mind to be able to use as dog food. And nonetheless, the fact that it became dog food today is okay. That is Rabbi Shimon totally. And therefore, if that's what the Tana wants to tell me in the Stam Mishnah, so then that must mean that I have to make Beis Hillel, when it comes to Shabbos, work out according to Rabbi Shimon, because otherwise there's a contradiction. I mean, on the one hand, we're Paschim like a Stam Mishnah, right? On the other hand, the one who's Paschim like Beit Hillel, can I get Beit Shammai? So I'm going to make now Beit Hillel be the opposite of Stam Mishnah? No way. So therefore, I, Reb Nachman, insist that the approach that I was Mekabel from my Rabbein is correct, and that when it comes to Shabbos, Beit Hillel is going to tell you, pick up the junk on your table directly. No problem, because it says you're allowed to even cut up an amela. So mukam lo beit hillel k'Rabbi Shimon. But when it comes to this Masechet, which is called, by the way, Masechet Yom Tov in many places, not Masechet Beit Sa, just because it opens the word Beit Sa. So Begabi Yom Tov, we're over there, Dafka, we have a Stam Mishnah, which I'll tell you in a moment, which is like Rabbi Yehuda. What is that? It's not. You cannot cut up wood from a pile of roof beams. Okay, now obviously that's true even according to Rabbi Shimon, because roof beams that were set aside for building, those are very expensive. They're long pieces of wood that you spent a lot of money on, and obviously that is Muktzeh Malchus Chisaron Kis, Rabbi Shimon is Meida. But the next word that says that if the roof beam broke into pieces on Yom Tov and it collapsed, and it says you can't even use that. Why can't you use that? According to Rabbi Shimon, you should be able to use that because he doesn't hold that once something was Muktzeh, it's always Muktzeh. Remember that the world is your roof beam. And therefore, you should be able, when the roof beam becomes roi to use, you should be able to use it. I really should qualify that statement because it's not 100% true. I'm misrepresenting something, as Tosis points out. And that is that aliens would be considered to be Muktzeh, even according to Rabbi Shimon, possibly, unless they were already spotted on your gamma detector, you know. So the same thing is true over here. It would have to be talking about a roof beam that you were aware of was in, looked like it was sagging, and you were thinking, oh my gosh, this might break at any minute. So then Rabbi Shimon would be mad. Okay, but this is a whole side. Let's pretend that we ignore that particular issue. So in any event, since it says over here that you're not allowed to use it, or according to Rabbi Shimon, you would be allowed to use it, so then that means that a Stam Mishnah is paskening like Rabbi Yehuda when it comes to Yontev and roof beams for fuel. And because of that, I have to make Beit Hillel agree with Rabbi Yehuda when it comes to Yontev. I don't understand. What does that mean? You can't arbitrarily go around and make a Mishnah in one second one way and one another second the other way. I understand. What does Rabbeinu HaKadosh hold? I mean, who made this up? You couldn't have made this up. It must have Rebbe made up both of these Mishnahs. He decided who's going to be the Stam Mishnah, right? So why, when it came to the second Shabbos, did he write the Stam Mishnah with Rabbi Shimon? And Mishnah B'Yomtev, when it comes to Yomtev, he made a Stam Mishnah going like Rabbi Yehuda. Ah, that is because of his Svarah, Amri. Shabbat, which people take with a lot of Chumrah nowadays. So Shabbat, the Chamir of Elohati Lezuzulebe, if we allow you to carry things around and we don't go like Rabbi Yehuda, nobody's going to come to be Mezalzel B'Shabbos. Therefore, it was Mekel. And he would saw someone like a Rabbi Shimon. Again, because the whole point of Muktzeh is in terms of that initial Zilusa. So this is not just Stam, a side svara. It's innate in the concept of Muktzeh. Yom Tov, which is somewhat less chamur to people because of the very fact that we are allowed to do the kind of things that we do for the Erchol Nefesh and so on. So people are Atila Zulzulebe. If you're not careful, then you're going to ruin the ambience of Yom Tov. Because of that, he was Machmir, and he was Satam Lanker Rebbe Yehuda the Machmir, and that's the way to understand the Mishnah, which is a beautiful introduction to the whole idea. Yes, says the Gemara, except like for one question. I don't understand. You took this Mishnah, Reb Nachman, and you made it meaningful only because you insisted that we're talking about one of Ira's chickens, so that it was B'davka Omedet the Gadel Beit Sin. And that allowed you to get around the problem of Uchla de Ifras and to say that we're dealing with Muktzeh. I got a little bit of a problem with that. The problem is, why are we talking about eggs? What do eggs have to do with anything? Why don't we just talk about the chicken? I mean, what comes first, after all? So in that case, if we could have simply said, if you've got a chicken that was set aside for laying eggs and you get hungry on Yom Tov, can you eat the chicken? That's the question, no? So why did we start talking about the egg? It sounds crazy. Iachi, if that's the whole question, do we hold the Muktzeh, we don't hold the Muktzeh, then there's no particular meaning to the egg. So Iachi had a meflege b'beitza, liflegu b'tarnagolet. They could have argued about the tarnagolet itself. No, you know the answer to that, because we already had the discussion about whether there's a difference between nolad and Muktzeh. So therefore, there's an advantage in talking about the case of an egg, because there you get to the classic nolad. Beitzah Shenolda, there you go. So instead of just talking about Muktzeh, which I would have been limited to if I was dealing with the chicken, I therefore talk about the more fundamental problem about whether even when it comes to Noah, I would be matir, and therefore I want people to know that when Beit Shammai was matir, he was matir even the egg which appeared magically out of nowhere. Well, I mean, couldn't we have argued about the chicken itself to teach me that Beit Hillel is so machmir that he even asked just plain old-fashioned muktzah, not only Noah? That would be a big fit. Now, I know what you're going to tell me. You're going to tell me the standard answer to those questions, which are Korach da Teira Adif. We'd always rather show somebody who's able to be matir something because that takes clarity. Any idiot can answer something. So what's there? There's no point to tell you, wow, they're so clear about the Shita, they're ready to answer even the Tanagolot. I can also answer the Tanagolot because I don't know anything. So I'll say, I don't know. You know what? It better be Machmir. That's what everybody does. Now, if you want to show the Kayach is only in terms of Heter, not in terms of Isser. So I understand that. That's why we would want to show the Beit Shammai's Kayach of Hetera. But I still have a problem with that because, look, I could have said both. And remember that when it comes to the question of Machlokes Beit Shammai Beit Hillel, it's all very nice to show the Kayach of Beit Shammai. I mean, but basically everybody's thinking to themselves, okay, but whatever. I mean, but what's really the halach? I mean, the halach is going to follow Beit Hillel. So if I can, at no additional cost, tell me also in the same sentence the extreme Kayach of Beis Hillel, even though it would be a chumrah. I mean, isn't it worth it to do that? I could have just said both together. Tarnegolet hi u beit sata. That's all I need to say. That either direction, which would tell me both the Kayach of Hater of Beit Shammai, which doesn't interest me that much as the question of what's the halacha libra Beit Hillel, and it would have told me how far Beit Hillel is willing to go, that I shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that Beit Hillel is only answering Neilat, he's also answering just plain old-fashioned Muktza, and that would have made much more sense, and then we could have said, Beit Shammai omrim teachel, both of them, and Beit Hillel omrim lo teachel, both of them, and that would have been much better. So this approach of Reb Nachman runs up against a problem that's not innate to the approach. I mean, okay, I understand it's brilliant and it's a great way of introducing differences between Shabbat and Yontif, but it's a little bit funny in terms of the actual efficiency of the halachas that we're giving over, which could have expressed more with very little additional data needing to be put into the Mishnah. And that's hard to believe. You know, it's because of this, by the way, that there are many Rishonim who paskin not like Reb Nachman's approach over here, because the Gemara seems to be saying this is really problematic to Reb Nachman. The truth is, however, that actually the Rambam paskins exactly like Reb Nachman over here. Okay, the Rush doesn't agree, but that we'll talk about when we get to the issues halacha. Anyway, I say, says Rabbah, I say totally different approach. I would actually start from the opposite approach. I would say that we're actually talking about a tarnagolet almedet la'achila. We're not talking about a tarnagolet. We're not talking about Ira's tarnagolet at all. We're talking about Ira's sheep. Where are we? So we're talking about a tarnagolet that is meant to be eaten. Now, so you ask, I mean, if it's meant to be eaten, so why not eat it? And if you can eat it, why not eat the egg that it lays? Isn't that just basically an uchla de ifrat? Aha! Well, what I want to explain, says Rabbi, that the point, Rabbi, it says Rabbi, that the point over here is that we are introducing an incredible new concept, which extends far beyond your poor people's concepts of Muktzah and Nolad. Ach, you ain't seen nothing yet. What we are talking about over here is not just any old Yontif, but we're talking about, well, we'll see, it actually could be any old Yontif at the end, but the primary din is actually said about a Yontif that is a Sunday. What? Yep, a Yontif that is a Sunday. What's the problem with Sunday? I mean, I didn't say I wanted sunny side up, did I? Now, the problem with a Yontif that's a Sunday is that you've got a problem with Hachana. What is that? Hachana, as introduced over here, is not to be confused with eino min hamuchan, as we've used the word for muktzah, which would be the basis of muktzah, noila. Was it in mind? No, siree. This is a brand new concept, and in order to distinguish it from the general idea of hachana, we call it hachana de rabba all over. Hachana de rabba is rabba's brand new idea of a concept called hachana. And what is that? Now, Rashi seems to be clear that hachana de rabba is a d'oraisa, something of a machlokas, first of all, bichlal, whether it really is a d'oraisa, and secondly, how far it would extend. So what it is based on is the pasuk. Vaya bayom ha-shishi ve-hechinu et asher yaviyu. On every Friday, you've got to get ready and make your food prepared for Shabbos. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean make sure your cholent is ready? Does it mean make sure you've baked your bread because you're not allowed to bake it? No, because that, the pasuk says, beferish. If you need to bake something, you better bake it today. You need to cook a cholent, you better do it today. Well, obviously, because tomorrow is Shabbos, and this is how we're introducing some Nisirim of Shabbos, and you're not going to be able to do it on Shabbos. And besides that, prepare. So what does that prepare mean? Therefore, Rava understands that the idea of prepare means that in order to be able to eat on Shabbat, the level, and note that this is a fundamental issue about the nature of achila, the meaning of achol nefesh, both on Shabbat and Yom Tov, as we'll see. In order to eat on Shabbat, that has to be something that you define before Shabbat. This is my food for Shabbat. And what's more, it cannot have prepared itself naturally. It must have been prepared in advance by consciousness. That's what it requires. Perhaps even articulation, as Rashi says. You have to say, this is my Shabbos Seuda. Only that gives it the necessary chashivut to be food for Shabbos or for Yom Tov, which is also called Shabbat, Shabbaton. Now, Since Rabbah holds that by definition, if an egg was laid this morning, then that means it was completed on the day before. Uh-oh, that's no good, because this is Rabbah la timing. The Omer Rabbah, Ma'ayam ba'yom ha-shishi ve'echinat asher yaviyu. What this teaches me is that if it's a standard Friday, which is not Usr b'malacha, it's a normal erev Shabbos, then and only then can you do this hachana. So shishi, yes, chol is making the Shabbat, or chol is making for the other Shabbat, which is yontif. But you cannot prepare for yontif for Shabbos, and you certainly cannot prepare for Shabbos for yontif. And that's exactly what you did over here. Me, I didn't do anything. I was sleeping all night. Doesn't matter, but it means that the day of Shabbat completed this egg for you, and therefore it's not usable on Yom Tov. You can't eat it tomorrow. That's why we're talking about a Sunday. It's only a problem on a Sunday, and that is this specific Mishnah of a Beitza, which was known to be Yom Tov. I'm only a buyer. I mean, but come on. I mean, the Mishnah does the same thing about a Beitza, Shinolda. Beyantav Acher Shabbos, and the fact is that people do not eat an egg that was laid on a regular yantav. Now, what in the world is wrong with eating an egg that's on a regular yantav? I mean, come on. Elamiyata yantav be'alma tishtere. I mean, you can make a statement like this, don't eat an egg on yantav, if it was laid on yantav. Oh, says Rabbi, that's true. Once I have opened up your eyes to this amazing phenomenon called Hachana de Rabbah, and now that you understand that there is a case, namely, where Yom Tov comes out after Shabbos, where indeed this would be a violation of the whole idea of Hachana de Rabbah, because Shabbat cannot create a Hachana for Yom Tov. So, therefore, we make a Gezerah. Gezerah Mishum Yom Tov Achar HaShabbat. We answer every single Yom Tov, because if we allow people to eat on a normal Yom Tov, so then they will forget And they'll think that Sunday is just like any other day. But it's not. Because, in fact, you will be over, according to Rashi, a D'oraisa, in eating from something that was mukhan for Yontev on Shabbos. Okay, says Abaya, and on Shabbos. So suppose I want to have a raw egg with my coffee, you know, mix it with my coffee. There are people like that, you know. Don't look at me queer. So fine. So suppose somebody wants to have a raw egg on Shabbos, okay? How come you're not allowed to have a raw egg on Shabbos? So then it should be completely mutter, right? Because, I mean, what are we going to say? The egg is now just a normal Shabbos, but I could eat it. I could eat it raw. Now, this is a little bit strange. Because the truth is that even if I was going to eat the chicken, the egg is muktzeh because I can't check it on Shabbos. This is a whole problem of like, what kind of weird question is this? There's a lot of different approaches to what Abaye is asking exactly. But Rabbah answers, well, that's a different gzera. We're worried about Shabbos that would fall out after Yontev, in which case Yontev would be making the egg for Shabbos, and then you can't do that. What? Well, yeah, you're telling me that we make gezeiras to aser eggs that are laid on a Shabbat, any Shabbos, on any Yontev? And that means that your concept of Achana D'Rabbah is so powerful that it's the basis of gezeiras? Now here Rashi introduces a wonderful idea, gentlemen, that we've never seen anywhere else. Rashi is mechadesh that the idea of not making a gezerah that is based on an isser that itself is only a gezerah and a harchaka is usser from the Torah. Can you imagine? We usually think that we don't make a gezerah like a gezerah. That's because, I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, the Rabbanah don't want to make a gezerah. Well, they make the gezerah, that is sufficient distance, and they don't make a gezerah like a gezerah. But Rashi says, no. Basically, it's the pasuk of Ushmartem et Mishmarti, which, according to Rashi, is an actual Isser. So, Asu Mishmeret le Mishmarti, but do not, lo Mishmeret le Mishmeret, do not make a Mishmeret for something that you only created yourselves as a Mishmeret. Because what that would be doing would be presenting a Rabbanan, it would almost be beginner Baal Tosif, which is like the Ramban asks on the Ramban. I mean, according to him, the Rabbanan is a chiyav d'oraisa to be shomer. So then what does it mean not to add his points to the Torah? But this is goof for the point. You cannot make a Rabbanan primary. And if you make a mishmeret to the Rabbanan, then you're making it primary. So keeping that in mind, let's see where we go with this question. Because according to Rashi, we're dealing with a d'oraisa. He understands that the pasuk of Achana D'Rabbah is a serious issue, the Arisa. So I want to show you that we do not make gezeiras based on the Achana D'Rabbah. Because look, it says in the Braita of Ha'atanya, HaShochet HaTarnagolet U'matzaba Beitzim Gmurot, if you shecht a chicken on Yontev, and this is any day, I don't care when it is, it could be Yontev that comes out on a Sunday, it just says you shecht a chicken on Yontev, and you find completely finished eggs inside of the chicken that had not been laid. It says over here you're allowed to eat them on Yontem. Now, if you're telling me that people might get confused about Achana D'Rabbah, why would we not say, no, you can't eat them because what if we allow you to eat chickens inside eggs inside of the chicken, so then people will come to eat the egg that is misyaled and be a man. So, I mean, this would be a question of whether maybe it's a gzera la gzera, or I don't know. But it could be talking about the case where it's directly. You found it today. Omar Lay, you're right. But that doesn't mean we're never making gzera for Achana D'Rabbah. It means that there's a general rule that the Rabbanan never make a gzera on a milta d'lo shchicha. How often do you find fully, and I understand that back in the old days where people actually used to get chickens and not manufactured meat, you know, so when you had your chicken for Shabbos, all the kids in the family would fight over who gets to eat those delicious eggs that are inside the chicken. Yes, but they're not fully developed eggs. I mean, they're not ready to be hatched eggs. They're just the formative eggs, which are delicious. What do they do with them nowadays, I wonder? Such a shame. That was like the big treat for us on Shabbat. I don't know, like, what. But anyway, since to find a fully developed egg is not shkiach, we weren't kosher. But in a chinami, a yontev achra Shabbos, or a Shabbos achra yontev, which is a common enough occurrence, that we would be gozer on. Okay, so now we have two totally different approaches to the Mishnah. And one of them is Reb Nachman's approach. And Reb Nachman's approach is that we're talking about the question of Muktza and Neulad. And there's a difference between Shabbos and Yontev. The second approach that we just had is the amazingly brand new, exciting approach of Rabbah, which creates a whole new concept called Hachana de Rabbah, and is fundamentally new, extends beyond any concepts of Muktza. We'll have to talk about it a little bit more. We have some time as the sugya develops later.